Hello and welcome to Talking History. This is Brian LeBeau, Chairman of the Department of History at Creighton University, and I'll be your host for today's program. As we do every week, let's begin our program with a look at this week, December 8th to 14th in history. On December 10th, 1869, Wyoming Territory became the first area, territory or state, in the United States to grant women the right to vote. It was not until 1920 that the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution provided for women's suffrage nationally. On December 11th, 1936, Britain's King Edward VIII abdicated the throne to marry Wallace Warford Simpson, an American divorcee. On December 14th, 1799, America's first president, George Washington, died at his Mount Vernon, Virginia home at the age of 67. And on December 14th, 1939, amidst events leading up to World War II, the Soviet Union was dropped from the League of Nations. The League, you may recall, had been formed in 1919 following the First World War to preserve world peace. And we have three items for this week's History in the News. The first two have to do with slavery in America, or rather, its later-day repercussions, while the third deals with China. First, three reward posters for runaway slaves have been pulled from a Christie's auction in New York City after their content was made public and attracted protests. One of the posters offered a $200 reward for, quote, a Negro man, John, with a remarkable fine set of teeth. The posters and five other items from the period had been grouped into three sets, each valued at about $1,000. The unidentified seller has decided to donate the posters to a museum or historical society specializing in black history. Second, in a similar vein, the New Orleans Parish School Board has voted unanimously to change the name of its George Washington Elementary School in that city to Dr. Charles Richard Drew Elementary. The change of name follows a policy in that city that prohibits school names honoring former slave owners, like the first president of the United States, or others who did not respect equal opportunity for all. It honors the black surgeon who lived from 1904 to 1950 and who was known for developing methods to preserve blood plasma and for protesting the Army's practice of segregating donated blood by race. It's the 22nd such name change in New Orleans in the past 5 years. Also purged from the city's public schools have been the names of Confederate generals, slaveholding governors, and even the black founder of an orphanage, but who, like Washington, happened to own slaves. And finally, appropriately given our show today on China, our third item of history in the news has to do with the reported discovery in Italy of a 13th century European account of life in China. The account, it is alleged, was written by an Italian Jewish trader named Jacob, who identified himself as the son of Solomon of Ancona, a city in northern Italy, but about whom we know little else. Jacob's account places him in China 4 years before Marco Polo, Jacob arriving in Zaitun in southeast China in August 1271. The account provides extraordinary new images of 13th century China, at the time one of the most highly developed societies in the world. It recounts Jacob's six-month stay, during which he became embroiled in Chinese political debates so fierce that he had to flee for his life. And although it lacks the scope of Polo's epic, if it is authentic, it would be a major new source of information on life in medieval China. Zaitun, by the way, from which the English word satin is derived, was then one of the busiest ports in the world. Jacob describes it as, quote, a city of measureless trade whose streets were crowded with a vast ebb and flow of men and carriages. He was clearly awed by its fabulous wealth, but he was also deeply troubled by what he saw as its moral depravity, particularly among the city's women. He wrote, quote, thus these women give no value to being chaste, just as others think adultery no shame, nor even to bear children without concern, whom often they secretly kill. All these go about the streets wearing stuff so thin that a man may see their bodies, so immodest is their dress. May God spare me, he writes, for what my eyes have seen. Jacob goes on to describe a city riven by debates that echo those of today, with the elderly condemning young people for promiscuity, homosexuality, feminism, coddling criminals, and being obsessed with making money. "They bow down and worship the ancestors no more," one elder complained to Jacob. "It is for money and possessions alone that their foreheads touch the earth." Verifying the authenticity of the document has been made more difficult than usual by the refusal of its translator, David Selborne, a British scholar who taught at Oxford, to make the original text available to anyone else. Selborne says that he was allowed to see the manuscript and to publish it only on condition that he not show the original to others or reveal anything about the identity of its owner. As a result, although most scholars agree that the existence of such a journal is entirely possible, there having been many European traders visiting China in the 13th and early 14th centuries, it will be difficult to determine whether this account in particular is real. Well, apropos our last History in the News item, our major segment this week is on China, a subject made all the more timely by the recent visit of China's president to the United States. Our guest today, Indiana University professor Jeffrey Wasserstrom, will be interviewed by Creighton historian Robert Hopkins. Robert?
Thank you, Brian. The recent visit to the United States of the Chinese president focused as much on China's image in America as it did on substantive policy issues. For many Americans, the People's Republic of China is synonymous with Tiananmen Square, the transfer of democratic capitalist Hong Kong to authoritarian communist rule, and the repression of the people of Tibet. Recent films by such notables as Richard Gere have painted a harsh picture of life in China, raising strong doubts about America's association with a regime so closely identified with the widespread violation of human rights. But this is not the only image that Americans have of China, and therein lies the dilemma. A billion Chinese or a billion buyers of American soda pop, laptops, and jumbo jets. Here to help us resolve this schizophrenic American view of China is Professor Jeffrey Wasserstrom from Indiana University. Professor Wasserstrom was a consultant to the 1996 PBS film on Tiananmen Square titled The Gate of Heavenly Peace. His many publications include Student Protests in 20th Century China, The View from Shanghai, published by Stanford University Press. Welcome, Professor Wasserstrom.
Thanks. Thank you for having me.
One of the questions that almost everyone really appreciates is an understanding, is there really a schizophrenic view of China, or do Americans just receive this view from, say, the media or things around them?
Well, I think there really is. It's hard to separate out what the media presents from what the American image is. There certainly has been, throughout the last century, a waxing and waning of two very different contrasting views of China. Americans have been fascinated by an image of China as seen as a place poised on the brink of becoming somehow just like us, and another vision of China as being radically different, a kind of demonic other to the American way. And these kinds of images have waxed and waned over time, and of course there have been intermediary mixtures of these things that have come and gone.
You described the other almost in religious terms, demonic. Is this part and parcel due to perhaps the long history of missionary intervention in China and how they have portrayed to America and the West the Chinese people?
Well, I think there's a very real connection there, and I would think it makes sense to speak in terms of two waves or two different types of missionary hopes and fears about China, with the first wave having to do very much with Christianity and the hope for China being 400 million at that point potential converts to Christianity, as well as buyers of American goods. And more recently, the notion of conversion to an American vision of liberal democracy, with now the idea of 1 billion democratizing consumers who would again buy goods. There's been a continuity in the interest in trade following on the heels of conversion, but there's also been a continuity in the sort of hopes of this conversion. And when the hopes for conversion are dashed, that's when the vision of a demonic China tends to take hold. And you can find this as far back, or even farther, but especially the Boxer Uprising, which was then seen in the American mind as representing the not just the failure of conversion to Christianity, but the backlash against it.
Absolutely. We saw films like The Sand Pebbles and others, which portrayed the Chinese perhaps as incapable of appreciating or receiving not only Christianity, but Western ideals. Was this an example of that kind of hostility towards the Chinese?
Well, I think actually the best film example, which shows the interplay of these kinds of motifs, is 55 Days at Peking, which was released in the early 1960s. At a time when Americans were reeling from a feeling of having had our dreams of a democratic China crushed by the rise to power of the Communist Party, we have a film that revisits the Boxer uprising, but sees it very much through kind of Cold War eyes, in which the Boxer rejection of religious missionary activity is played out in a time when when China's rejection of the democratic missionary activity is very much in the American mind. So you have Charlton Heston riding in to save the besieged Western legations in Peking in 1900. But you have this being played out in the early 1960s when American forces are going to Vietnam to fight against another Asian country, in our mind, turning onto this wrong path that we were associating at that point very much with China.
Can you think of any examples of positive films about China that have received either critical acclaim or widespread attention here in the United States?
Well, what I talk about sometimes in my classes is an alternation between the Fu Manchu negative image of China and the Good Earth positive one. The film The Good Earth, based on a novel by Pearl Buck that was tremendously important in influencing American images of China in a positive way in the 1930s, presented the Chinese as sort of yeoman farmers, very much like Americans, only oppressed beneath a system that if only that could be shrugged off with a little bit of help from Western ideals and Western education, could then unleash this population that really at heart was just like us. And during World War II, a very powerful film by Frank Capra in the Why We Fight series presented China as peopled by a set of individuals who there were collages of their faces, and they were made to seem very much like Americans in all sorts of ways, essentially like us. And that was poised against, at that point, the demonic Asian other being Japan. And Japan was presented in very much the kind of Fu Manchu negative models that at another period in time had been used to discredit China.
So for many Americans, a Chinese farmer was no different than, say, a Piedmont, South Carolina dirt farmer. They were just like us, and what we were looking for was a way to equilibrate those societies, to make them comparable. How, if I may ask, since you've been to China, since you've spent many hours and days there, how do the Chinese view these American images of themselves?
Well, it's hard to generalize in that sense. I mean, there has been, though, I think it's important to note, a comparable, in some ways, Chinese fascination with America as a country that's radically different, but perhaps has a sort of special relationship to the United States. It changes dramatically, though, over time, and in part, there's a dynamic going on between the two, and certainly there's a good deal of anger and concern within China when America goes into a period of demonizing China. And one thing that concerns me about the demonizing of China, especially today, is in some sense it plays into the hands of the Chinese Communist Party, which no longer has a great deal of legitimacy or popularity among ordinary people. But one thing that it can draw on that does resonate with people is an image of China as unfairly criticized by the outside world, as potentially isolated by the outside world, as potentially ganged up on by other countries, as looked at in an unfairly negative light by other countries. And in a period of demonization, such as we've had and during this last couple of years, we're giving the Chinese Communist Party too much good material to quote, to use in their propaganda campaigns, to say that ordinary Chinese should allow them to remain in power, even if they don't like the Communist Party, simply because the Communist Party is strong and China needs a strong force to stand up to a potentially threatening outside world.
How do Americans and Westerners in general react to that dichotomy in rhetoric, the consumption for the Chinese people by the Communist Party, for example, the reaffirmation within China that Tiananmen Square was an appropriate course of action, that the violence, that the deaths were all an appropriate course, whereas the public rhetoric outside of China, the international commentary, has been perhaps more conciliatory? How are Americans to read these two different comments?
Well, I think it's important to realize that there are always, in a sense, multiple explanations of an event going on, one for domestic consumption and one for international, and this is just part of making sense of the world. And in fact, during the Tiananmen protests themselves, there was, in a sense, a dual language being spoken, one for external and one for internal consumption among the protesters. There would be banners that, when playing to an outside audience, when they were written in English, the slogans would be ones that resonated very well with American ideals and to a certain extent, other Western ideals. There would be quotations from people who we were familiar with. Patrick Henry, "Give me liberty, give me death. We shall overcome. Long live democracy." Things like this. And within the Chinese language text that the protesters distributed, or even some of the banners they put up, there was a tendency to emphasize more the nationalistic themes of the protest. The idea that the protests were an attempt not so much to reject the Communist Party, but to get it back on track. A theme in the protests to object to corruption and bad governance, more than necessarily to embrace a foreign ideal. And so I think that we need to, if we're going to unpack these kinds of different playings to different audiences, we need to realize it's something that goes on within the dissident community as well, and to a certain extent is within the government.
So in many ways, it's a two-level game. I think, for example, in Korea, we tend to see news flashes of student riots and focus upon its relationship to the government, when in fact, many people fail to appreciate that these riots are often linked, for example, to post-final exam periods, and students use it as a way just to get it out of their system. So are Americans by any chance being confused by these two different levels, that the Chinese students, for example, the protesters are looking for correction of corruption rather than any kind of sweeping democratic change?
Well, I think there is. I think there's been tremendous confusion in our tendency, and it goes back to these romantic and demonic images of China, both of which I think get us away from real understanding, the tendency to read all Chinese action as either embracing or rejecting our ideals rather than something more complex. That when you have something, a protest as complicated as the 1989 demonstrations, there were many different kinds of motivations. And it doesn't make it any less admirable, ultimately, far from it, an upheaval than it was. But I think to reduce it to simply, as it was often reduced, the Chinese students trying to create a system like ours, but somehow not quite understanding what our system was and not quite getting it right, not quite having a full enough, rich enough understanding of democracy, I think that's really to belittle them. I mean, I think it's very important to see them as motivated by a whole host of concerns, some of which involved rejections of the Communist Party outright, some of which were just calling on the Communist Party to live up to its own stated ideals.
Is it realistic, then, perhaps for Americans to consider that democracy, Western ideals, the liberal capitalist world order, even has an opportunity to exist in China?
Well, I think it's unrealistic to expect other countries to conform precisely to a series of to a situation that arose in our case by a confluence of very different strands that just happened to converge in a particular way. I think we continually fall into this trap. The most recent trap of it is to assume that a move toward privatization of state industries, which has just happened, will somehow naturally lead to an opening up into a more pluralistic political system, when it's very unclear that these things naturally go together. They're just different strands that can be combined in all sorts of different ways.
One of the things that certain critics have said about Chinese leaders and Chinese policies is that in many ways they're no different than the traditional Manchu emperors, or perhaps even more extremely, the Nazis. Are these sorts of comparisons or analogies helpful or even useful?
I think those two analogies, which have become very prevalent recently, are tremendously misleading in different ways. The analogy of current leaders to dynastic rulers, and you heard this a lot when Deng Xiaoping was dying, and there was talk of him as a last emperor of the Red Dynasty. The problem is that, at least with Deng, and now with Jiang Zemin too, there are just fundamental differences between them and any Chinese emperors. The imperial system, which varied over time itself, was based on succession through bloodlines, and neither Deng Xiaoping nor Jiang Zemin inherited their position from a blood relative or had any thought of passing it on, that we know, to a blood relative. They're also part of the bureaucracy that rules China, the bureaucratic state machinery, whereas emperors stood completely above it. And for no other reason than those, it seems to me that the imperial analogies are deeply flawed. The Nazi ones, which resonate very, very powerfully in the West, I think are very troubling as well. And the most basic thing is I'm a harsh critic of many human rights practices within China now, but it seems to me that one of the very, very basic defining characteristics of the Nazi human rights abuses was that people were abused on the basis of who they were, with the blood that ran in their veins, rather than things they had said or things they had done. And now it seems quite clearly that the people who are being put into the Chinese gulags, where conditions are atrocious, tend to be put there because either they committed crimes that weren't political, or if they committed political crimes, they themselves said or did things that could be interpreted as things that the state didn't want them to say or hear. They aren't put there simply because of who their parents are.
Well, this really reflects one of the common problems Americans have, and that's a lack of understanding about the background. Could you very briefly suggest maybe one or two books that our listeners could enjoy to give them some more understanding there?
Well, one of the best books about American images of China remains a book by Harold Isaacs, who lived in China for extended periods of time, called Scratches on Our Minds, American Views of China and India. And he updated it. He wrote it first in the 50s, but he updated it several times, taking stock of the very radical changes in American foreign policy toward China, such as Nixon opening relations again. But talks also about how patterns of images, some of which I've referred to, continued over the breaks in policy changes. Another book, a new book that I think is very good, that provides you with some context on which to speculate about where U.S.-Chinese relations are going, is edited by Ezra Vogel, and it's called Living with China. And it just came out in 1997 from Norton and should be available in most bookstores.
If you would, Professor Wasserstrom, in our few seconds remaining, can you give us a good one-sentence summary about how our leaders can help, or listeners can help, formulate their own ideas about images of China?
Well, I think one of the key things to do is to take with a grain of salt either a very optimistic reading of China, such as one going out now, which seems to be this notion that privatization will inevitably lead to conversion to an American way of life, but also take with a grain of salt the demonic presentations of China as a completely radical other to what we are, and look beyond the headlines for a more complicated idea of what's going on, the distinctive path this China's taking that will not make it either just like us or radically and threateningly different necessarily. To look for sources of disagreement that we have and to focus on those, but also to look beyond the simple answers of categorizing China as pure good or pure evil.
Well, I appreciate that very much. We've been talking with Professor Jeffrey Wasserstrom, author of Student Protests in 20th Century China. To say that America's multiple perceptions of China are driven by some special image of the Chinese people and their culture is perhaps unfair. Indeed, Americans have consistently viewed China as one giant market, a place to sell not only merchandise, but ideology. China has been slow to welcome either unrestricted trade or political change, aggravating American impatience and enthusiasm for progress. But this response is not unique to China, as Americans have for nearly two centuries linked economic and diplomatic relations with other countries to their willingness to embrace Western, particularly American, social attitudes. Historians have long pondered this relationship between the flag and the cross and what it tells us about the American psyche. In asking questions about American images of China, perhaps we are really asking about our image of ourselves.
Continuing our theme today on China, our weekly radio op-ed piece providing an historian's commentary on an item in the news is titled An Effective American Policy on Tibet. It was written and will be delivered by A. Tom Grunfeld, who teaches East Asian history at the State University of New York, Empire State College in New York City. Professor Grunfeld is the author of the book The Making of Modern Tibet, and he is a writer for the History News Service.
President Jiang Zemin visited the U.S. recently. He was dogged by demonstrators, especially those advocating Tibetan independence. Tibet and its leader, the Dalai Lama, have become chic and fantasized and romanticized as only Hollywood can do it. Consequently, demonstrators, journalists, and members of Congress have been pressuring President Clinton to do something on Tibet. But publicly humiliating and bullying China is not a rational foreign policy, however good it may make the China bashers feel. In a cynical act intended to appease domestic critics and win popular approval, the president has now appointed a special coordinator for Tibet. This special coordinator will not be permitted to travel to Tibet and can do nothing more than keep up public pressure on the Chinese, something that is already being done. This appointment shows a woeful ignorance of U.S. Tibetan and Sino-Tibetan history. In 1950, China reasserted its rule over Tibet, and a revolt ensued, climaxed by the Dalai Lama and some 60,000 Tibetans fleeing into exile. From the early 1950s to 1971, the guerrilla war against China was aided by the Central Intelligence Agency, whose goal was not Tibetan independence, but the destabilization of the government in Beijing. When the fighting ended, the Dalai Lama and Beijing continued to hurl invectives at each other publicly, but privately engaged in talks. These talks, currently on hiatus, hold the key to the Tibet issue. There are two factions in the Chinese government. One wants to strike a deal with the Dalai Lama, granting Tibet true autonomy, freeing political prisoners, halting Chinese migration to the region, and granting cultural and religious freedom. For his part, the Dalai Lama would return to Tibet and accept Tibet as part of the Chinese state, something he has been willing to do for years. The other Chinese faction believes Tibet to be a nuisance, cares little for its culture, and would just as soon wait for the Dalai Lama to die. Meanwhile, it encourages the migration of ethnic Chinese into the region in the hopes that Tibetans will become a minority in their own land, thereby seriously jeopardizing the very survival of Tibetan culture. An American special coordinator can only strengthen the hand of the hardline faction, who repeatedly cite the history of the Dalai Lama's intrigues with foreign powers, intent on creating domestic unrest in China. Indeed, the hardline Communist Party chief in Tibet has just this month called for a crackdown on members of the other faction. If the intent of the U.S. is to help the Tibetans, then its policy should be to work diplomatically to bolster the group willing to talk with and compromise with the Dalai Lama. Current U.S. policy indirectly aids those in China opposed to the Dalai Lama. Bill Clinton will have to choose which is his genuine priority, domestic politics or the people of Tibet. For the moment, he has decided on the former.
Once again, you've been listening to A. Tom Grunfeld, author of The Making of Modern Tibet. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show. If you have any comments to offer, send them along to us by email at talkinghistory, all one word, care of Creighton.edu, or by regular mail at Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton in Omaha, Nebraska at 68178. Until next time, from Creighton University, this is Brian LeBeau.